This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. New information and new developments on the coronavirus are coming in every day, but public health experts say the pandemic has not yet reached its peak. In cities across the country, notably large cities like Chicago, LA, and New York City, major hospitals are reporting a desperate need for more supplies, more hospital beds, and more space. The obvious question for Indiana, of course, is how prepared are we? Calling in now are two leaders from Eskenazi Health. David Crabb is chief medical officer there. Thanks for joining us, David.
My pleasure.
Graham Carlos is chief of internal medicine at Eskenazi Health. Graham, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
All right, before we get into it, I'd like to get a good understanding of your roles at Eskenazi. David, what do you do as chief medical officer?
Well, in the normal run of business, it has to do with things like overseeing the quality and safety department, medical staff, credentialing of providers, coordination of care, or coordination of services between, say, surgery and medicine and dermatology and gynecology, that kind of thing. It has shifted largely towards helping review and communicate policies, serve as a go-between with us trying to obtain supplies and the medical staffing of the wards and the intensive care units, and then things that just pop up that somebody's got to try to answer.
And so with regard to the COVID-19 pandemic, you're the person who is in charge then, from my understanding of what you just said, of getting, say, ventilators. Extra ventilators.
That's part of it. What you realize very quickly in what we call the incident command mode, we gather not too close, but we gather in one place for a large part of the day so that I can turn to someone who is looking at what is available for masks or gowns or ventilators and get the very latest update without trying to make phone calls or email. So it's more about each of us brings a certain level of expertise, and we need to share it with each other so that someone who knows the computers really well or the supply chain doesn't make assumptions about what we need and how to get it to people.
So then, if that's your role, what are, if any, your concerns about the supply of those needed materials and devices?
This is common to I think, every health system in the world now. There's a combination of a huge increase in demand for a lot of the supplies we use to protect ourselves, just because we used to use these isolation gowns and masks on the inpatient service to protect the patients from us sometimes and not to spread things from patient to patient, like C. difficile, or to isolate someone with a pretty uncommon problem like measles or tuberculosis. This is at a scale that's unheard of. So the amount of protective gear that we're using is probably 100 times greater than in ordinary times. Plus, some of the supplies we ordinarily would get come from places like Italy or China where they're shut down. They're not making as much. So we go day to day. We have pretty good data on our usage of gear, how much we have in stock. We can calculate how many days supply we have. And we've had to use this to inform the policies that we've put out to extend these maximally and balance out our supplies and the protection of the patients and our staff.
And Graham, what is your role as chief of internal medicine?
Well, I wear several different hats here at Eskenazi Health. I'm a pulmonary and critical care doctor, so I'm in the intensive care unit and in the COVID units, seeing and taking care of patients, supporting our staff. I'm wearing a hat over all of internal medicine specialties, so cardiology, nephrology, pulmonary and critical care. So we're working together to establish telehealth. That's been a major project last week, such that we don't have patients coming in for clinic appointments anymore. We're engaging with them with telehealth for their own safety in this time of pandemic. And then finally, as I work with the command center and Dr. Crabb, one of my most important roles is to be what I call an ambassador of accurate information. So I'm trying to take the information and feed it both ways, feed it from the command center to the frontline staff so they know the latest policies and protocols and why we're doing what we're doing. But then also being on the unit, I'm able to take information back to the command center. What are we seeing? How many patients are on ventilators today? How many discharges do we anticipate? What needs do we have today? And what needs to we anticipate in the future?
I think the telehealth note is something that, I mean, it certainly affects all of us. So, for example, I had my first telehealth experience this morning. I woke up, felt dizzy, had a bit of a headache, some light sensitivity. I thought maybe I was having my first migraine or something like that. So I figured I'd call my doctor. They explained that they are doing telehealth visits, of course, because of all of this. And we had a quick 15, 20 minute phone call. For me, it was a very positive experience. Is there a learning curve that physicians have to overcome to kind of shift to telehealth, or is this something that you've been doing for a while?
Yeah, Matt, there is a learning curve, but it's a very rapid rise. In other words, it doesn't take but one or two visits to start to feel comfortable with telehealth. And the amazing thing about it is, I would have guessed that because it is new for us, that our providers and our patients wouldn't like it very much, but our experience has been the opposite. Patients are so grateful to have a call and a check-in. They've recognized that healthcare is in the middle of a crisis and people are stretched pretty thin. And so we've had some really great stories of patients who have expressed gratitude and providers who really appreciate the ability to see their patients but not have to come into the hospital and put themselves at risk. So it's really been a win-win, and I bet it'll change the way we do healthcare forevermore.
David, what has your reaction been to all the news about bed shortages in hospitals around the country?
Well, it's reminiscent of discussions that I was in back in the 2000s after some of the avian flu concern. People who weren't listening in on that, there were strains of influenza that were very pathogenic and in a lot of ways have parallels to the coronavirus. So we went through a lot of planning and reading about the 1918 pandemic. So what is happening now is actually something that had been foreseen, and in disaster planning, people had already thought through it. And I think maybe the best example of that, and I think it timed out fairly close, is when the new Eskenazi was under planning, was not that far after the concern about the pandemic avian flu. And so it informed the engineering of this building such that we can use virtually all of our adult beds as intensive care rooms. This is something that can't be done, you know, with an old hospital. And so bed shortages, ICU shortages, those were things that people had thought about and did what they could to make us, you know, versatile. I think there may well be another phase. It could be in any community where you have to look at alternatives, such as what we've seen in New York City with the Javits Center being converted to large wards to take care of patients. So it's a concern. There's a lot of moving parts when you do it. You have to have the IT to support it, medical supplies and staff in particular. But it is something that's actually in our plan books.
Graham, this may be a question for you. It may be a question for David, but I'll ask you, has I guess, the priority of keeping certain inpatient patients in the hospital changed? Like, have you had to review whether or not a patient should be there because you know you may need the bed space in the future or the very near future?
Yes, we're actively looking at all our patients, working with our case management services to see patients who, let's say, are waiting to get to go to a rehab facility, who are going to need more of an inpatient type rehab. We're working closely with those facilities to help those transitions of care happen more expeditiously. We're also working really closely with our health partners around the city, trying to understand what the census is at various hospitals as we start to experience this surge here in Indianapolis, so we know what other resources we might have should we get full. One of the hospitals in Indianapolis, University Hospital, which, as you might know, houses a lot of cancer patients and has a bone marrow treatment unit, we're trying to keep that as a non-COVID hospital as much as possible. And so I know hospitals are trying to work together to say, okay, if you have a non-COVID patient that's ruled out, would it be possible to get that person to University so that we can fill up space for COVID patients in other hospitals? So those types of discussions are ongoing every day.
Say, if I could add something, Matt.
Go right ahead.
I think something that is probably not well recognized is that even before this happened, the hospitals in this region and probably lots of other places operate at fairly close to capacity. So the reviewing of people to be able to go home in a timely way is something we do every day, because we have to maintain the capacity to take in, say, people with heart attacks or trauma patients and so on. And it's not the hospitals start out being 85 or 90% full. And so knowing that, it's maybe a little easier to understand that a surge, the word that we're using all the time, rapidly fills up hospitals. There was never a lot of extra capacity.
However, has I guess the discretion that you use, have you found that it has come down to a kind of a concerning level where you've kind of got to ride that line between should we send that person home, should we move that person, or should we keep them here? Are there concerns around that?
Well, there's a funny thing that has happened, and that is we are not as full of the other types of, you know, sort of regular medical problems as we ordinarily would. We're wondering, I mean, I think people are staying home. They're coming to the emergency room with respiratory symptoms and, of course, the serious emergencies. But I think a lot of people who otherwise would have sought care are kind of toughing it out. We're not seeing them as often. So that led temporarily to us having more beds than we had had in years. And now they're filling back up as more and more of the COVID patients are getting sick and coming to us.
What can Indiana cities learn from what's happening in other places?
One of the things that we have a little glimmer of hope on is that the early institution of social distancing and closing down gatherings and restaurants and so on, we're beginning to see some signs of that working. And the statistic that I've been looking at is the increase in the number of patients with a diagnosis in Marion County and the state. This comes up every day at about 10 o'clock. And in the worst hit areas, this went up not just like by 200 a day, but 200 one day, then 300, then 400, 500, something called exponential growth. Ours has been linear. And so what that means is the percentage growth is sort of slowing down. And I think that means people are not coming into contact with others and contracting the infection. So that's a bit of a hope that it's slowing down enough that our capacity in the healthcare system is going to be able to accommodate the sick patients.
We will be back after the break with our two guests from Eskenazi Health to talk more about how hospitals in Indiana are dealing with the pandemic and preparing for what's to come. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how hospitals in Indiana are dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. We're on the phone again with two guests. David Crabb is Chief Medical Officer at Eskenazi Health, and Graham Carlos is Chief of Internal Medicine there. And Dr. Carlos, you started to have a follow-up on what to expect and also treatments that are being talked about and going around in areas that are being harder hit, say, out west or in big areas like New York. What can we expect?
Well, we're learning more and more each day. Just yesterday, they published, I believe it was 4 or 5 new articles in the New England Journal of Medicine. We're seeing a lot of data come out in various other journals talking about the natural disease progression of COVID-19. We've learned a lot already about what symptoms to expect. Obviously, this started with fever, cough, shortness of breath. I'm sure you and the listeners have heard that this loss of taste and smell seems to be emerging as a common symptom as well. And then we're discovering the impact of certain treatments. Obviously, hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin was a treatment early on that many people were hoping would be the cure-all. We're not seeing that to be the cure-all for COVID-19. So we're working on that combination as well as other antiviral combinations and some immune inhibitors like tocilizumab, which is an antibody directed against an inflammatory response to the virus. We're hopeful that each day more and more trials will come out that will inform our tactics to treat these patients. For now, a lot of what we know is supportive care, oxygen if needed, and wait and see on the treatments and protocols and data as it comes out. I think hospitals and healthcare systems all over the country are trying things that have some evidence, but we've yet to see a cure-all for COVID-19.
David, go ahead.
Well, I was going to add in a really amazing thing is how much we have learned as fast as we have. The virus was cloned and sequenced, and we knew all kinds of things about it within a month or so of the first cases. The clinical trials are really in high gear. They're being published very quickly. As Graham said, there was a burst of them that came out yesterday from people that were in the hospital probably about a month and a half ago. This is unprecedented, but it also brings with it the concern that you move as fast as you can, but there may be inaccuracies and there may be problems that we will only be able to sort out when we have lots more information. Science and medicine moves forward by little steps, and it's common to have early reports of medications or new therapies or new surgeries being highly successful, but as experience grows, we have to modify that. And that's one of the things that I think is pretty frustrating and confusing to people who don't live in this area.
David, I'm going to ask you a straightforward question, but it's a concern that's on a lot of people's minds. The more they learn about this and the more they learn about hospitals' ability to deal with it, will Indiana's hospitals, do you think, have enough beds when the surge comes?
We are doing about everything that I think can be done to achieve that. And I'll give you a couple of steps in that. We've had very good help from the Fairbanks School of Public Health and the State Board of Health to create models to help us know what's going to be coming in the next couple of days, as well as a couple of weeks. And that's extremely helpful so that we can time the arrival of things that we need, and we can staff up and create additional rooms. Let me give you an example. We have a lot of regular hospital beds here that can be used for intensive care, but they need to have special monitors. And we don't just have a bunch of these in a warehouse somewhere. We just got a big shipment of these that will allow us to outfit another 40 beds that we didn't have last week. Other hospital systems that we're talking with are doing the same thing. They're converting non-ICU areas into ICU areas. So it's that combination of anticipating what we will need and using the space that we have in the hospitals to get there. The hardest answers are, of course, can we get as many of the supplies and hardware we need, the ventilators, and will we have enough people to run it all? The latter is being approached by really very innovative kind of ideas about how you make a pyramid to take advantage of the most experience you have. So you have someone like Dr. Carlos overseeing people who are not as well trained in critical care medicine, but can carry out the work that needs to be done, pairing them out in some cases where we have teaching going on with residents and interns, maybe other medical specialists who are not trained in critical care. And the same is happening with the nurses. We have an ICU nurse with additional nurses who ordinarily would work on the floor, occupational therapists and physical therapists, to just get the amount of work that needs to be done. So it's a way of expanding our workforce with the people that we have, moving them into new roles.
And Matt, the reason your question is nearly impossible to answer is because you don't know when you've reached the peak until you're on the other side of it.
Right, right. On the subject of ventilators, we've heard about, you know, manufacturers coming together to try to make ventilators. We've heard about, you know, some automakers trying to reconvert factories to make ventilators. Is there any word on when those might arrive, or even whether or not they will be up to medical spec, and can we trust them?
I have not heard any official word on when they will arrive, nor have I seen any published reports on their use yet in hospitals. So a lot of that is to be determined. We have worked here in Indianapolis with the School of Medicine on doing what's being done in New York, and that's taking the ventilators that we do have and figuring out a way to split them so that you could have one ventilator to two patients. This would involve using check valves and flow regulators so that the patients don't cross-contaminate each other or share the same air, so to speak. We're hoping it doesn't get to where we would have to do something like that, but we're preparing just in case. We're also figuring out how we can use other machines that can also assist in ventilating a patient, machines that would more commonly be used in an outpatient basis, but if you had to, you could use it on an inpatient. So we're finally working with surgery centers and other places that aren't doing surgeries to gather their ventilators as needed in the event that we have this surge. So a lot of it is still to be determined. I will say that many hospitals, because of the Seattle experience, were able to see this coming and put in orders to companies to try to get ventilators shipped out as soon as possible. And some of those have been coming in. So hopefully more and more will be available in the coming days and weeks.
Dave. I don't think there will be a concern about whether they work well or not. I mean, the specifications and what they're supposed to do is well established, and I'm sure it's a matter of industrial capacity, not whether they'll be good ventilators when they make them.
And David, what about the different kinds of protective masks? Are you looking at concerns about shortages there?
Yeah, certainly. We've managed to keep a fair number on hand, and they've come out of all sorts of places that would probably surprise people. A lot of these masks, because they filter out particles, they get used in a lot of things where you don't want to inhale, say, dust or a fine grit from grinding and so on. So a lot of the supplies have been augmented by industry where they're donating their supplies that they would have used for a non-healthcare reason, but they're perfectly functional for us. We are learning ways to extend them by sterilization techniques so that they will be used more than, say, you know, for 15 minutes and thrown away like we might have done 6 months ago. At another level, we have had, and I'm sure this is springing up all over the place, we have groups that are making sort of in small operations things that we need more of, like washable gowns and surgical masks. So I think this is welling up in lots of places that's going to relieve many of the things that we went through kind of a dip when our supplies had dried up and we'd run through what we had on hand.
We're talking with David Crabb, Chief Medical Officer at Eskenazi Health, and Graham Carlos, Chief of Internal Medicine at Eskenazi Health, about hospitals and their capacity in Indiana to handle the COVID-19 pandemic. Have there been any discussions on finding alternative hospital spaces here like there have been in some other cities? Are we looking at other buildings or places to put beds?
People will know that there have been a very successful effort that the State Department of Health put in to help patients who do not have another home to go to. Obviously a real big problem. You can't send someone home to self-isolate if they don't have a home, if they don't have people to take care of themselves, and we don't want them congregating in shelters. So I think that's an example of providing a physical location with medical and other care to take care of people. Repurposing of buildings, I think it's fascinating to see how you can take a large convention center and just put a bunch of dividers and beds and have a good alternative for certain people. This is logistics. This is like the Normandy invasion to make sure you've got enough oxygen and medicine and food and everything else you need. But it's possible.
And Eskenazi has said that it's been preparing to scale up for months. And what has that looked like?
Well, the things that we see, that if you physically walked around, what you would see is some doors that are shut that you maybe didn't know were there. It's because of our ability to change the airflow patterns that was designed in it. In other words, it sucks air out of the corridors into rooms and then out of the building. It's so-called negative pressure room. And that's something that most facilities have, but they have it for those rare patients, like I said, the measles or the tuberculosis. And we have the capacity to do that virtually across the hospital. So you see the closed doors. Other than that, the rooms are very similar. They were built intentionally to be so similar that people working in that room would always know where things are. And the difference will be now it will have a great big monitor instead of a small monitor. And then get ventilators, and you'll see the higher acuity of care, like a typical intensive care unit room.
And how do you know, I guess, how much to scale up for something like this?
You go as far as you can, as fast as you can.
Yeah, simple answer. Yeah.
Well,
I guess
let me be more specific.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
We started, and Graham will probably give me, I think we started out with 48 intensive care beds, another 24 of sort of an intermediate level, and then 104 sort of standard room for a patient. We're trying to make all of them capable of being an intensive care unit.
Mm-hmm. What, I guess, are the biggest challenges in front of you right now that are making it harder to scale up as much as you would want to?
From my perspective, the staffing and supplies are the biggest challenges. In addition to the masks and PPE you've been hearing about in the ventilators, to take care of somebody who's critically ill, you need extra IV pumps, extra IV tubing. You need lots of medication, particularly medications that sedate people and keep them comfortable on the ventilator. And hospitals all over the country are short on these supplies now because they're using more and more of them, but that's becoming an issue we're concerned about. In addition, it's our own staff, our nursing staff and respiratory therapists. Dr. Crabb was mentioning how we are, you know, training people to oversee multiple staff members and help teach them, equip them, and take care of patients. That process is ongoing, but it takes a while to train people up, to get people comfortable enough, particularly to take care of a critically ill patient. So getting our staffing up to speed is another big issue we're working on right now to be prepared to take care of, say, north of 200 critically ill patients here at Eskenazi.
And I'll say one other thing that's closely related to that is just the support of everybody for each other. You know, we're all concerned. This is a scary disease. You don't have to be old and sick for this to really harm you. And so people come to work knowing that there is an unavoidable level of danger in doing this. This is everywhere in the world. We are so impressed by the attitude and basically the courage of everybody. We're doing all we can to support them in terms of keeping them updated with information, letting them know why we make decisions that we have to make, and wherever we can, providing for things that's more like physical comfort and reassurance. And we're grateful to the community for shipments of food and candy and letters of support and flowers and stuff like that. So it's been gratifying.
And as are we. I don't want to editorialize too much, but I mean, you and those like you are the real heroes here. I guess, is testing being done there at Eskenazi, testing for COVID-19?
We do not have the laboratory test kits to do them here. We have kits ordered, and as you would imagine, they're back ordered because every other hospital wants them. There's numerous kits. They work with different basic lab machinery, so it's not like one kit works everywhere. So those are ordered, but lots of demand for it. So we are working through the State Department of Health and its partnership with Eli Lilly for most of the testing we're doing.
And are you also testing physicians on a regular or semi-regular basis?
We're largely following the guidance from the State Department of Health, which emphasizes testing people with symptoms. And then there's a long list, healthcare workers and people with chronic diseases. And I won't go into this. I think it's on the State Department of Health website. As opposed to say an asymptomatic person who is just mainly worried. Most of the emphasis has been for those people, unless there's overriding reasons that you want to know about their status, such as ability to work for a healthcare worker. The general recommendation will be, if you might have been exposed, if you're worried about being sick and you don't have to work, stay home and monitor yourself and be back in touch if you develop symptoms.
And we have a nice resource here in Indianapolis. We have Eli Lilly is offering to test healthcare workers, provided they have a doctor's note or order. So that's been a nice way for us to quickly funnel people there to get their test and potentially get them back working again if it's negative.
Well, and a lot of the talk around all of this is the limited number of tests that are out there. And so there are protocols as to whether or not to test. And do you want, as healthcare professionals, as physicians, do you want the amount of testing to increase?
Yes, I would think more testing is going to be better. I'm particularly interested not only in the diagnostic test, which is the PCR test that we're currently doing, which basically amplifies and checks for the virus in your system. I'm really interested in these antibody tests as they come up and come along, because then we'll know what people actually have developed immunity to the virus. I think it'll be a powerful combination to be able to see, number one, do you have the virus actively? And then number two, are you immune to the virus? I think it will help us understand better how it's impacting our workforce and help us strategize for when and how people can come back to work. More tests also would be better in that we can triage and cohort patients earlier. Right now, many hospitals have what we're kind of calling rule outs, meaning you sent the test and you're waiting on the turnaround time from the health department to the lab and back. And we treat these patients with full PPE, assuming they have it. And the quicker we're able to rule them out, the more PPE we'll save. And then we could potentially cohort them in areas away from other COVID patients. So as more testing comes online, I think it will help us take better care of patients and steward our resources better.
Graham Carlos is Chief of Internal Medicine at Eskenazi Health. David Crabb is Chief Medical Officer at Eskenazi Health. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking about how hospitals in Indiana are dealing with the pandemic. We're on the phone with David Crabb, Chief Medical Officer at Eskenazi Health, and Graham Carlos, Chief of Internal Medicine there. How has the state's response to this been so far? Is the governor's administration moving as quickly as it needs to?
I feel like the state has responded in a timely fashion, using the information they had at hand at the time to make wise decisions, particularly with regard to social distancing. We're starting to see the impact, I believe, of social distancing on our community and in terms of the spread of the virus. We're not seeing things exponentially increase every day anymore. It's more of a kind of linear increase. And like many of our listeners, I'm hopeful that with this ongoing social distancing, we can start to bend the curve and flatten the curve here in our Indianapolis community.
And Graham, would you say that had we not taken these steps, had the governor not taken these steps, would we be overwhelmed? Is it easy to say that?
I think it's pretty easy to say that. We have good evidence that if you don't practice social distancing, the virus will more rapidly spread through the community and quickly overwhelm healthcare capacity.
Yeah, it seems like a lifetime ago, but only maybe 2 or 3 weeks, we were wondering whether all the basketball tournaments and stuff were going to happen. And that would have been the perfect way to spread this to many, many more people.
What about the federal response so far, David?
Well, I think if people looking back on this, and this is not a new idea, but had we been able to have more of the kits, test more broadly, and identify people that were kind of the sparks for spreading it around, we might have been able to use some of the tactics that have been used in other countries to slow it down better and earlier. But that's, you know, that was limited by the numbers of tests and the decisions about how and who would be tested. And, you know, we've come well beyond that.
Yeah, everyone's a pundit now, and so everyone has an opinion, but it's not always an informed opinion. Could we have done this better, or did this come on so fast that we have done about as well as we could?
Well, Matt,
this is so new for our country. We've seen that in China and Korea, when they've dealt with SARS outbreaks before, they quickly battened down the hatches, got everybody isolated from one another, and they were able to flatten the curve really quickly because they had seen it before, they had experience. Here in the U.S., this is pretty new for us, and it's taken a huge impact on how we live our lives as families, and schools closing, and everything from getting groceries to homeschooling. It's our first go-round, so I expect us to be a little rocky going into this, but I do believe that we will learn from this, we'll grow through this, so that next time a virus starts to emerge, I think we'll shut things down even faster.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of joking around that come July, we'll look back and realize what we should have done differently.
And what do you want to happen at the federal level? What would help the most? What should they be doing?
Well, obviously the stimulus for some of the hardware and the supplies that we've seen about, you know, industrial level of production of all the stuff that we need, and that includes medications and things that are not quite so front and center in the news, is really important. The decrees to keep people quarantined is really, really important. We cannot stop the social distancing prematurely. A lot of us are watching to see what happens when, now that China has liberalized the travel around Wuhan and so on. This is not a disease that goes away just because you've stopped having cases in one city in a huge country like that. And many of us could imagine smaller waves of this going on for some time.
Obviously, what the federal government wants to do is balance the safety of the citizens of the United States and along with the economy, and we want to make sure that things stay somewhat stable. What kind of a timeline, as a healthcare professional, do you think we should realistically be looking at as far as when we might get back to normal?
I think maybe we can say a number of predictive models that have come out of the University of Washington have suggested that the peak numbers may occur about mid-April, 16 days from today. There's a fairly wide margin for error in that, and that's just the peak. If it takes us 4 or 5 weeks to get to the peak, you know, it's fairly symmetrical. It may take us that long for it to slow back down again. I would not be comfortable making projections.
But if it does take longer to get to the peak, isn't that in a way a good thing, sort of proof that we have been able to flatten the curve?
Yeah, a low, slow peak would be preferable to an earlier spiky one.
And are hospitals around Indianapolis and around the state talking and working together, sharing solutions and efficiencies?
Yep. We have a twice-a-day phone conversation between the regional hospitals here in Marion County and the surrounding counties that is doing that. And the State Department of Health has a sort of a planning center along with Indianapolis Emergency Medical System. That's our ambulance system for maybe 60-70% of the ambulances. We're on these conversations, as I said, twice a day for coordination of our work.
And is there worry at Eskenazi, where you are, that this could have a big impact on the hospital's ability to treat other patients? We've seen reports from hospitals in other cities and other countries about healthcare workers being forced to choose who gets care and who doesn't.
Yeah, Matt, that's been one of my concerns from the outset, is that as you're stretched on resources, especially essential resources like rooms and ventilators, I worry about the collateral effect this could have on our ability to take care of other critically ill, let's say trauma patients and such. This is why the measures that we're taking now to mobilize ICU, scale our staff, are going to be so important, because it's not lost on us that we still need to take care of those essential needs like we always had. I think that when you look at the number of deaths worldwide, you may be fooled by just looking at those people that die of coronavirus. I think we need to keep in mind that there may be other people who are dying in these areas of outbreaks, these hotspots around the world, just because they aren't able to get the care that they normally would have received.
That was going to be my follow-up. Have we already in Indiana seen collateral victims of the coronavirus?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it's something we're concerned about, but we actually right now have lower hospital volumes for our standard care patients. Again, not doing as many elective surgeries. And then I think a lot of people are just choosing to stay home. That may change here in the coming weeks, but I'm not aware of any quote unquote collateral damage at this point. It's certainly something we're keeping our eye on, though.
It's hard to get at that information if you wait for things like death certificates to accumulate and then analyze them. I think we will be able to know that, but not very quickly.
We're talking with David Crabb, Chief Medical Officer at Eskenazi Health, and Graham Carlos, Chief of Internal Medicine at Eskenazi Health, about Indiana Hospital's response to the coronavirus pandemic. And we're also talking about their ability to treat patients once the peak hits. So, David, how many, or perhaps this is a question for Graham, how many hours are nurses and doctors working right now?
Right now, we're working standard hours. Nobody is going over. Some people are taking extra shifts to help as we see more patients coming to the hospital. We actually are being very intentional with our physicians, creating a process where people would sign up, say, to work 1 or 2 weeks in a stretch and then have a week off. We know that we need to maintain a healthy workforce. We know that a tired workforce is at increased risk of getting ill, and they're not going to be as effective at taking care of patients. So we want everybody to stay as sharp as possible. Clearly, as needs increase, we may have to cut into that some, but we're starting out keeping wellness in mind for all of our providers as much as we can.
Could that change, though, if we see a rapid increase and you just simply need the personnel? Could we see shift increases as far as length? Could we see more staff taking more frequent shifts?
I think so. We have an incredible resource with the School of Medicine here at Eskenazi Health, where we have residents and fellows. These would be people that have received their MD or DO, and now they're doing specialized training, say, in a field like gastroenterology or a surgical field. One asset we have from that standpoint is the ability to mobilize more and more providers to help in our workforce. In addition, we are getting people that are volunteering to work in areas that they wouldn't normally work. So now that outpatient practice has gone pretty much all over to telehealth, we have a new pool of nurses and techs and MAs and LPNs that we can plug in and utilize to do maybe some of the tasks that a nurse in the hospital would normally have done. In addition, one thing that's been a big strain, Matt, as I think you know, is we don't have family members in the hospital anymore. So the task of communicating with families about their loved ones is a huge one. And so we've had many people volunteer to step up who don't want to be on the front lines taking care of COVID-19, but are more than happy to look at the chart, call and communicate with family members, answer questions, and so on and so forth. So while we may become resource strained in some other ways, new resources are opening up at the same time.
Dr. Carlos, we've had you on the show before, and I think I remember this from our previous conversation. Correct me if I'm wrong. Are you over residents, new physicians that come in to work at Eskenazi?
Yes, we, myself and a variety of our providers are teaching and training and supervising them every day.
How much of a shock to them has this become? Have you seen anyone, and obviously don't name names, but have you seen anyone feel like they've gotten overwhelmed? Like, is this really what I want to do? Coming into the field just as this is happening? Or has it been perhaps just the opposite for some of them?
The analogy I'd use, David mentioned Normandy earlier, is that there was an initial phase, Matt, where you approach the beach and the gates dropped and it just felt like bullets were coming at you in the form of fear, new policies and protocols, trying to keep up with the medical information and then see and recognize and take care of patients. And during those first few days where we were starting to see our first patients, I sensed anxiety in all of our providers, but especially amongst our learners. They were looking to people like myself and their other faculty members to see, are they calm? Are they cool? Or are they also anxious? And so I found it really helpful to check in with the learners and hear what they're most worried about and understand their fears. Now that we've kind of gotten past the beach, so to speak, people are just ready to work. That's been my sense. There is in the back of our minds a sense of fear, a sense of anxiety, because a lot of this is out of our control. But most people feel a calling to do their duty and to learn and to take care of people, which is why we went into medicine in the first place. the polling I've done on social media and just informally in terms of why are you coming to work every day in the midst of this pandemic, knowing you could be at risk of contracting the virus. Most people say, Matt, it's a calling and a duty, a calling and a duty. And that's what's driving people each day so far. And I believe will keep driving us in the days to come.
Have you found it to be a challenge in any way to instill confidence in the safety protocols, these extra safety protocols that you're having to take?
I can answer this.
Go for it, Dr. Graham.
Yeah. So when you look at the evidence for the protection and so on, this is not something that has been a real high priority across the world. We look back to examples from the SARS outbreak and publications from Canada and work that includes the CDC and the World Health Organization. And they've looked at these in different situations, different levels of resources, and they have slightly different recommendations. On top of that, there's an awful lot just being spread around social media, personal views, interviews with a single individual. There's lots and lots of noise out there that's hard for people to sift through. And so one of our main jobs has been to try to come back as well as we can with the evidence we started with and the evidence that we gain week by week to inform what we do. And then that leads to our policies changing, and that's a little hard to explain too, but we keep coming back. I love the little motto, facts, not fear. And the more that we can instill this and have people learn to focus in on what the best information and evidence is, the better off we'll be.
And have some of those untruths out there really affected your ability to handle what is coming? And have you seen people come in who seem to be paranoid and they shouldn't be worried about what they're worrying about?
Are you talking about patients or about people that we're working with?
Well, I guess both. But when I asked the question, I was, I guess, specifically thinking of patients. Has anyone shown up to the emergency room worried that what they have might be COVID-19, though they're showing none of the symptoms?
Sure. Yeah. One of the things that comes up with testing sites and so on is people wanted to be tested. And if we were following the guidelines, say, from 2-3 weeks ago from the State Department of Health, they didn't meet those criteria. They didn't have any symptoms and we had limited tests. So they were, you know, in isolated examples of people being upset that they couldn't get that.
And what about concerns, primary concerns that some of your staff has had? I'm talking about doctors, nurses, even support staff. What kind of talk is there internally about your safety?
Well, I think that I'll go back to what I said about trying to stay as close to the evidence. Doctors and nurses and pharmacists and everybody here is pretty smart, and they can reason by analogy and they can raise questions about what we see in the, say, World Health Organization or CDC guidelines and wonder if maybe a protective process or policy should be extended to something else. And we've actually had what has happened fairly broadly is professional societies have sort of independently started creating recommendations, but they're largely not based on the evidence that we're trying to stick to. And so fairly regularly, something will come up where one group or another will raise an issue, and we simply have to go over it with the data that we have and reinforce that, not only the policy, but the process of reaching the policy. And I've become sort of accustomed to doing this and knowing that it's a natural part of the way people are addressing this fear.
David Crabb is Chief Medical Officer at Eskenazi Health in Indianapolis. David, thank you so much for your time today and for what you're doing.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Graham Carlos is Chief of Internal Medicine at Eskenazi Health. Graham, thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Join us tomorrow for the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on the news of the week. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.